chance to give him that information that my friend Harper had written? That weird stuff. How many of you got a chance to read that strange stuff that my friend Harper wrote? That new agey kind of stuff about natives in South America materializing. I was hoping that you would have read that, because I know that some of you would have rebelled against it and wanted to. Maybe you could bounce some of your questions off Dr. Fernandez and get some of his views on that. I just gave it to him, and I'm sure he's conversant enough with those ideas to be able to address some of those issues too. So we'll go ahead and turn it over to Dr. Fernandez now, and go ahead.
Okay.
Pay attention, folks.
I do come from the traditional Christian worldview. I classify myself as a conservative evangelical Christian, and I do have a PhD in philosophy of religion, so I am trained in philosophy, although I focus on those areas of philosophy, the thoughts of philosophers that overlap with religious issues. Mr. Cahoon asked me to briefly dialogue on a few different philosophers and a few different ideas, and so that's what I'm going to try to do. It's the limitations of time. I can't do justice to any of these individuals or ideas, but I think we will be able to scratch the surface, maybe increase some interest. And yes, I will be putting in a Christian perspective, or at least a Christian perspective, putting a kind of a Christian spin on it. But I think if we're all honest, even like Bertrand Russell, the author of the textbook, he comes into it with his own biases, coming from more of an atheistic or at least an agnostic worldview. In the 1940s, he debated a Jesuit priest named Frederick Copleston, one of this century's greatest historians of philosophy, and I come more from Copleston's standpoint, that of the Christian theism, the belief in a personal God, and the belief in traditional Christianity. Now, your instructor asked that I would just comment briefly on Bertrand Russell, a little bit about his background. You already know about his background, but I just want to say something about Russell. I have tremendous respect for the late Bertrand Russell. He was a great mathematician and a very precise thinker. I believe in one work that he co-authored, he was trying to prove the whole system of mathematics, and it took about 300 pages just to prove that 1 plus 1 equals 2. So he was a brilliant, brilliant thinker. At the same time, I think probably the weakest work that he has is his work, Why I'm Not a Christian. It's a collection of essays that he authored. And I think that this great thinker, basically, when it came to trying to deny the existence of God, he argued more along the lines of overstatement. He's basically arguing more on the third grade level, I think. I've heard much better argumentation against Christianity than I've heard from Bertrand Russell. In fact, when I ordered this book, I really found that it was a letdown, because I had read other works of Russell, and he was very, very impressive, a very precise thinker. But here's an example of his argument, one of his arguments against the existence of God. He states on pages 6 and 7 of his Why I'm Not a Christian, "If everything must have a cause, then God must have a cause. If there can be anything without a cause, it may just as well be the world as God, so that there cannot be any validity in that argument." Then he states, "There is no reason why the world could not have come into being without a cause, nor on the other hand is there any reason why it should not have always existed. There is no reason to suppose that the world had a beginning at all." There's a lot that can be said here. First off, he's correct. If everything must have a cause, then God must have a cause. He's correct there. But I do not know of any solid Christian thinker throughout the history of philosophy who ever argued on that premise. Christian thinkers would argue along the lines of this, that everything... Sh- that has a beginning needs a cause. Or they would argue that everything that exists that has dependent existence, its existence is dependent on something else, needs a cause. So he would not take the a lot of the problem is, this is called a cosmological argument. There's a confusion of two different types of cosmological arguments with Leibniz's cosmological argument. So there's a confusion between explanation and cause. But in the end, if Russell had read a little bit more in depth the Thomistic type arguments, the Thomas Aquinas, the arguments of the Muslim philosophers, and also used by St. Bonaventure, and then had a better grasp of what Leibniz meant by explanation, he would see that they were basically not arguing that everything needs a cause, but everything that has a beginning needs a cause, and eventually you have to arrive at something that has no beginning. Eventually you have to arrive at eternal existence to ground the temporal existence of everything else. And so I think it's a straw man argument. He sets up a straw man rather than his real opponent, and then he knocks it down and says he wins that debate. Another problem there, he says there's no reason why the world could be eternal. There are some good philosophical arguments, mainly brought about by the Muslim philosophers, called the Kalam cosmological argument, that would philosophically, through reason, argue that the universe had to have a beginning. I don't want to go too in-depth in it, but basically what it amounts to is, if the universe is eternal, it would take an infinite number of moments, an unlimited number of moments, to reach the present moment now. But since we have reached the present moment now, but the problem is you can't traverse an actual infinite set of anything. No matter how many moments you've traversed, there'll still be an infinite number more to traverse, otherwise it wasn't an infinite set to begin with. So in other words, there can only be a finite or limited number of moments before the present moment now. In other words, there had to be a first event in time. That goes along the Kalam philosophical arguments. But now we also have scientific arguments against an eternal universe. Carl Sagan used to hold to what was called the oscillating model, that there were many Big Bangs before this Big Bang, even an infinite number of Big Bangs, and there'll be an infinite number from here on, so that as the universe, there was a Big Bang, the universe expands, eventually gravity pulls it back, then you have another Big Bang and another Big Bang, on and on infinitely. Not a very popular view among scientists today. The weight of the scientific evidence is against it. The universe is not dense enough for gravity to pull it back. That's number one. Number two, even if it was dense enough, there's no known law of physics that once the universe is pulled back together, that would bring about another Big Bang. So basically that's been rejected. There's also the steady state model, that somehow the universe just remains in this constant state and it is eternal. The evidence for the Big Bang model basically refutes that. That is not a popular model. So the basic model that's accepted, the concept that's accepted by most scientists today, is that of a Big Bang, the beginning of the universe. Scientists talk about the universe, that as we go forward in time, the universe expands in all directions, much like that of an explosion. If you go backwards in time, the universe gets more and more dense until you reach what scientists like to call a point of infinite density. I'm quoting them, these are the terms they use. Also, they refer to it as a point of dimensionless space. Okay. Problem is, a point of infinite density, for something to be dense, it means small. Infinite means without limit. For something to be small without limit basically means it's non-existent, it's not there. A point of dimensionless space, if a point doesn't take up any dimensions in space, it takes up no space. Again, these are just two academical or intellectual ways of saying nothing. At a point in time, the Big Bang shows, if you go back far enough in time, the universe was not. And so the Christian would basically argue, basically what I'm saying, there's good philosophical and scientific evidence that the world as we experience it, the world as we know it, the universe as we know it, is not eternal. It came into existence. Now, Russell argues there is no reason why the world could not have come into being without a cause. And this is exactly what Stephen Hawking and a lot of people are arguing. Most leading scientists today accept that the universe had a beginning, but refuse to accept that there's a God who created it, and so now they're trying to speculate how the universe could have a beginning, but not need a cause. But as far as I'm concerned, everything that has a beginning needs a cause. Something couldn't cause itself to exist. If something that has a beginning caused its own existence, that'd be ludicrous, because it would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to bring its own existence about. Obviously, you can't pre-exist your own existence. So the idea that nothing could produce something, you know, nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. So from nothing, nothing comes. Therefore, if the universe had a beginning, it needs a cause. And so I would argue along those lines, which is exactly what Frederick Copleston, the Jesuit priest, did back in the 1940s. It was covered over the British Airways on radio. And I think most commentators, both atheist or agnostic or Christian, would agree that Copleston won that debate. So basically what I'm getting at is that the options that Russell lays out for us, first off, he misrepresents Christianity as saying everything needs a cause. No, we're not arguing that. We're saying something has to be uncaused. Something has to be eternal that brought into existence all else that came into existence. But basically, you either have an eternal universe. These are the options. An eternal universe, a universe with no beginning and no end. Or you have a universe with a beginning, caused to exist by nothing, just pops into existence without a cause. By the way, in quantum physics, there's some guys who want to try to argue in that direction. Even I agree with Albert Einstein. He refused to accept that. He basically said, hey, God does not play dice. He was referring to Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy in quantum physics, which some people take to a conclusion that I would not, saying that things can happen without a cause. Einstein's basically saying if things can occur without a cause, if events can occur uncaused, then the whole basis for modern science crumbles. Because who cares if you show in a lab that A caused B? Once you go outside that lab, B might come into existence totally without cause A or any other cause. So modern science presupposes a rational background for the universe, that the universe makes sense, that effects have causes, that there is a rational relationship between the things. Basically, that's why modern science was founded by the Christians, by the way, Blaise Pascal, Isaac Newton, Galileo, that type, those type of people, guys who at least believed in the existence of a personal God who, through reason, created the universe in a reasonable way, so that man, who was created in his image through reason, could find out about the universe in which we live. That's why Isaac Newton referred to science as thinking God's thoughts after him. Okay? But basically, the options that, even as spelled out by Russell, either the universe is eternal, or it was caused by nothing, or as the Christian would say, it was caused by another, and the other that the Christian would argue for is God. Modern science, and I believe philosophical principles would rule out the first two. And so I think we'd be left with it's caused by another. Further argumentation, which we don't have time to go into, would argue that ultimately the cause would have to be an eternal uncaused being. But whatever the case, what I'm getting at is Russell, who will take 300 pages to prove 1 plus 1 equals 2, will dismiss the existence of God in a paragraph. And despite the fact that volumes have been written for the past 2,000 years on, in fact, 3,000 years on the subject, And then, you know, he'll say, they said, well, what would happen if you died and you saw God? He said, well, I would tell him he didn't give me enough evidence. Well, maybe he put too much of his thought and his research into 1 + 1 = 2 and not enough into where did we come from. And whatever the case, Russell says something that I find tremendously honest coming from him. He talks about the world in which we live, because he believes that no God exists. He says that it's purposeless. This is page 106 and 107 from his Why I'm Not a Christian. He talks about it being purposeless, without purpose, more void of meaning is the world which science presents for our beliefs. So he admits that if there is no God, there's really no meaning to life. Listen to what he says. And he talks about building our philosophical systems of thought and trying to achieve that which we set out to do, building that on the firm foundation of unyielding despair. This is what Russell says on page 107. The article is titled The Free Man's Worship, and it's in Why I'm Not a Christian. That man is the product of causes which had no provision of the end they were achieving. That his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast depth of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of the universe in ruins. And so Russell openly admits in a moment of honesty that if his views are correct, everything that you ever fight for, everything that you ever stand for, every good thing that you've ever done, the fact of the matter is, in the end, it's going to be totally meaningless and without purpose. The way I put it is, a million years from now, it's irrelevant whether you live like Mother Teresa and helped people, or live like Adolf Hitler and slaughtered people. If there is no God, if there is no God and there's no life after death and no judgments or rewards for the lives that we lived in this life, a million years from now, it wouldn't make any difference whatsoever, because every person you ever influenced is going to have ceased to exist, as will you, and as will our solar system and the human race. And I'm not saying it's going to happen in a million years from now, but basically, eventually, that will be the outcome. So Russell openly admit that if his views are correct, there's nothing but despair, there's nothing but, there's no meaning, no purpose, whatever we do is not going to amount to anything significant in the long run. At the same time, he says, you know, let's join together and build a better world. And my question is, why? If Christianity is true, then we have got every reason to build a better world, because there is eternal significance. King Solomon said about 900 years before Christ that God has put eternity in the hearts of man. And my dog, that died recently, never thought about life after death and things like that. But the fact of the matter is, we human beings do think about what happens after I die. That's why we fear death so much. Some of us, our deaths won't be as painful as some of the sufferings that we go through in life. So it's not the suffering that scares us so much as what comes next. Will I cease to exist? Is there a God? That type of thing. God put eternity in our hearts so that we will not be satisfied with just temporary meaning with a small M. We need meaning with a capital M. Otherwise, in the end, ultimately, everything we ever did, everything we ever stood for, will die with the death of the universe, with the death of the solar system.
If I could say something, when Dr. Fernandez was talking about the existence of the universe and this cause or causeless universe, remember, you have to go back to the chapter on Leibniz. Is that Leibniz or Leibniz?
I call it Leibniz, but it could go either way.
I don't know if you remember or not. I tried to point out Leibniz postulated, I think, four causes or four proofs of the existence of God. And you might want to go back and review those, because that's pretty much what Dr. Fernandez is talking about. Okay, just wanted to refresh your memories and apply what we've got in the text with what he's saying, so that you have a point of reference. I'm sure you're going to go walk away from here thinking about everything he has to say, and a point of reference will be in the book.
Okay. Yeah, and one thing I would say about Leibniz, too, is that his view on... when he talks about God as a self-explained being, he does not mean that God is a self-caused being. He's using explanation differently than the word cause. Even some Christian philosophers fail to realize that. And so when Leibniz argues that everything that exists needs an explanation for its existence, he's not saying that everything that exists needs a cause for its existence. So he's looking for a being that contains within itself its own explanation, and that explanation would not be that God is self-caused, but that God is uncaused. So there's a semantical debate about Leibniz there. I want to read to you, I want to move on to Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche was one of my favorite atheist philosophers. Probably my favorite atheist philosopher. I really disagree with everything the guy said, but I just love the way he said it. But I just want to show you, people are going to talk about Nietzsche and talk about his views, and you might get the impression, unless it's a large work on him, you might get the impression that this guy just laid out all these rational ideas. This is my idea. And he didn't really. I mean, this guy was into writing stories and parables, and you can make a case that, well, he basically died insane, but that only made his writings more interesting in later years. I mean, this guy was, I mean, it's kind of like the guys who have studied Nietzsche, it's a lot like studying poetry. It's not just philosophy. You got to get past his poetry first and say, okay, he told a nice story, now what does it mean? And but it just shows you that not all philosophers are boring. This is the portable Nietzsche, edited and translated by another atheist, Walter Kaufman, who's famous for referring to man as the God-intoxicated ape. He believes that we're apes, but the main difference between us and the apes is we think about God, and our whole lives are just debates about God's existence and thinking about God. Whereas apes don't do that kind of thing. So I think it begs the question, well, why is that difference there? The Bible will say man's created in God's image. What's that?
How does he know if they don't? Just because they can't talk to
them. I think the burden of proof would be on those who say that they do. I mean, when you just look at a dog and the way the dog lives, and then find dead dogs, bones, remains of dead dogs, you don't find them buried, and you don't find them buried, unless they were buried by humans, but you don't find them buried in such a way that shows evidence of belief in the hereafter by dogs. I think the same could be said for, when's the last time you saw an ape buried somewhere with some kind of evidence? I mean, this is not something that's in debate between Christians and non-Christians. We're all in agreement that when they start classifying, okay, this thing here are the first humans, the evolutionists, and I don't hold evolution myself, but one of the big factors is the way they would be buried entails religion and belief in the hereafter. The Egyptians would bury their kings with gifts and things that they thought maybe they could take with them into the hereafter, and certain things set up for protection against evil spirit entities or whatever in the hereafter. But whatever the case, it's a good question though. But the portable Nietzsche, you'll get just about everything Nietzsche wrote, and it's a really good work to look into. But one of his writings entitled The Gay Science, he doesn't mean the same thing as the common usage of the word gay, and he just means it basically in the happy type thing. But basically, science is just basically man's knowledge and that type of thing, trying to find truth. And Nietzsche had a lot to say about that. But he has a little section called The Madman, and Nietzsche stated this. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, "I seek God, I seek God"? As many of those who do not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Why did he get lost?" said one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" said another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage or emigrated?" Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his glances. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I shall tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Is there any up or down left? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? God's too decomposed. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves?" Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground, and it broke and went out. "I come too early," he said then. "My time has not yet come. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of man. This deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves." And then he talks about churches, and what are these churches now if they are not the tombs and sepulchers of God? Basically, Nietzsche is the madman. And what he's saying is, he's looking around at all his buddies, because of modern technology and because of modern philosophy, they believe that they had disproven the existence of God. And so all these atheists are clapping their hands and saying, "Yeah, God doesn't exist." And there's Nietzsche just coming apart at the seams because he agrees with them that God doesn't exist. And so what he's telling them is, he's saying, "You guys don't understand. Yeah, God does not exist. But that means that we have detached the earth from its sun. The whole center for our existence is gone. We have detached meaning from our lives, and we don't even realize it yet." And so what Nietzsche's saying is, he's saying, "I'm a man before my time, because I was the first to recognize the consequences of a world without God." Nietzsche further argues, he calls for the overman, or some would call it the superman.
This is important because we'll be talking about this next week or the week after. We will talk about Friedrich Nietzsche, so pay attention to this and correlate it to what you do in the reading.
And so he talks about the overman. He said that basically what has happened is that if God is dead, and when he was saying that God is dead, he was not saying that God was alive once and he died. What he's saying was God was an invention of man's imagination, man's wishful thinking, kind of Freudian and along the lines of Feuerbach, that man created God rather than God creating man. But they were saying man intellectually grew up throughout the history of philosophy and reached an age that so that in the 19th century, man realized that God did not exist. And so what happened was the concept of God or religion died. It was no longer the center, the driving force of Western civilization. Okay? Now Nietzsche was saying, "Well, what my atheist colleagues don't understand is that there's going to be some big consequences here. If God is dead, then traditional values have died with him." Nietzsche also argued that if God is dead, the whole concept of absolute truth has died with him as well. So he's saying now, we're going to go into it, and Nietzsche died in the year 1900, but he predicted that the 20th century man would be man come of age, the atheist come of age, where we would start to live more consistently with our atheism, which is what Nietzsche was calling for. So he predicted the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind, and he's correct. Unless the 21st century is more bloody than the 20th century, more people, so I think it's over 120 million, more people have been butchered by their own governments in this century alone than all the people who have died in wars, the whole entire history of mankind put together. And by the old Soviet Union and Red China, those two countries alone killed almost 120 million of their own people during peacetime. In fact, you could actually make an argument, the nicest thing you could do to Red China or the old Soviet Union when they're really slaughtering their people is to invade them, because then at least they arm their people to fight their enemies, whereas rather than their people being defenseless and being slaughtered. I'm not calling for invasion, but what I'm just saying is that it is pretty bad, and it has been bad in a century. So Nietzsche hit the nail right on the head. This was a guy that knew what he was talking about. He was the kind of, you got philosophers of today. They'll talk about the ideas of today. Every once in a while, you get a philosopher of tomorrow. Every once in a while, you get a philosopher who says, hey, look, what we're doing is debating the ideas of today. Well, this idea is won out, so I'm going to tell you what tomorrow is going to be like because of it. And that's what Nietzsche was doing. Now, with Nietzsche, the thing was that he redefined the good, or basically that the greatest drive of man is the will to power, okay? Nietzsche rejected the soft, what he called the soft values of Christianity, compassion, love, kindness. He believed the soft values of Christianity were fostered a slave mentality and held back human creativity. Because we put ourselves in a box, thou shalt not this, thou shalt not that. And so what he argued was that Christianity was holding back human creativity and human progress. And so he said, now that God is dead, we can throw out those soft values, they don't make any sense, and we can implement a master mentality of hard values. Nietzsche had a low view of woman. He had a high view. He glorified war and that type of thing. Basically, what he was saying is, since there is no God, we can play God. And so by calling for the Overman, he was calling out he was basically saying, we need a group of men to arrive on the scene with the courage to create their own values now that God is taken out of the equation. Nietzsche basically said that these Overmen, through their will to power, would come up with hard values and would basically force their values on mankind and would basically further the progress of man. So he did not see this as a step backwards for man. Once the soft values of Christianity are taken out of the way, even though the Overmen are going to bring on war and that type of thing, he saw that as an advancement, a step forward for man. That's why he's calling it the Overman, not the Underman. Okay? He saw that as a step forward, that man could be more. And he basically referred to man as a bridge, that a man is a bridge between ape and the Overman, and that they needed the courage through their will to power to create their own hard values. But whatever the case, the guys who applied these teachings in a lot of areas were the Nazis, and they were beginning to do it while Nietzsche was still alive. Yeah?
Oh, my suspicion. It sounds like he was saying that, like what you said, man is a bridge, then man can become divine?
He's kind of moving in that direction, but really keep in mind there is no divine in Nietzsche's thought. But man can become better than man. He believed in evolution. We used to be apes. As far as he was concerned, because of the soft values of Christianity, we were still in the ape mode. And he was telling his atheists, we need to move on, cross the bridge into the Overman stage. Now, the thing was, when the Nazis tried to apply his teachings, Nietzsche's thought formed a very small basis for some of their ideas. They got most of their ideas from the world of the occult and theosophy, an occultic belief system and that type of thing. But whatever the case, Nietzsche was opposed to their anti-Semitism. Main reason was the Nazis viewed the master race, the Overmen, as a group of people, basically a nationality, a race, the Aryans. And the non-Aryans might pollute the genetic code of the Aryans, the master race, and slow down their future evolution into the Overman. Therefore, the master race should remove all non-Aryans, okay? Exterminate them. Nietzsche disagreed. Nietzsche, when he was talking about the Overman, his emphasis was on the individual. So he was looking for a group of individuals. So he was not anti-Semitic. He was opposed to the anti-Semitic rhetoric and behavior of the Nazis. And but the fact of the matter is, what the Nazis did, he probably would not have opposed if they came from groups of people from all over the world, different nationalities, who shared the vision of the Overman through their will to power, created these hard values and forced them on everybody else. He probably would not have had a problem with that. But the fact that it was the master race was viewed as one race being superior to other races was something that he opposed. So basically, Nietzsche was basically arguing, you got these wimps that are being nice to everybody, and if God is removed from the picture, basically man is free to fill in the gap left by God and say, we are going to force our values with a vengeance on everybody else. Whatever the case, Nietzsche eventually died insane. His sister, she needed some money, so what she basically did, she began to, she was basically collected his rent. Nietzsche was not as popular during his life as he was after his death, and so she got paid by the Nazis, and I believe also by Mussolini and the Italian fascists, to basically keep his writings alive. And so that's how she made her money. So a lot of times people think that Nietzsche was pro-Nazi when in actuality he was opposed to them, though he was not anti-Semitic. His views, I think, would have been just as bad, if not worse, but they would not have been applied to a racist mentality. He was looking more at a collection of different individuals coming together. Okay, Spinoza and pantheism. Let me talk a little bit about Spinoza. Technically speaking, Benedict Spinoza. Technically speaking, he really wasn't a pantheist, but he was so close to it. He was so close to it, and his views were so unique that rather than come up with a term for what his view actually was, usually they classify him as a pantheist. The real articulate writers of the history of philosophy would just say that his views were very close to pantheism. So let's talk a little bit about Spinoza.
Are you going to define pantheism for us?
Yeah, and pantheism. In fact, I should define it in relation to theism. Now theism, you've got Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And it's basically the belief in a personal God. Who is separate, theism, separate from creation, but involved with his creation. So he's separate in that God is not the world. God created the world. At the same time, he is actively involved with the world. He can perform miracles. He sustains the universe in existence. There's deism is a view where God is separate from the universe, but he's not involved with it. He leaves it alone once he created it, so he doesn't perform miracles. Okay? You've got polytheism, is the belief in many gods. Okay? So there's a lot of different world views here. Well, pantheism is the belief that God is the universe. Okay? Now, the twist that Spinoza puts on it is that he believes the whole is more than the sum of the parts. So it's kind of like God is, in one sense, God is the universe, but in another sense, God is beyond that, at the same time, the universe is really not viewed as separate from him. So he's got a twist there that it's hard to explain. From what I understand, it doesn't even make any sense unless you come at it from Spinoza's whole philosophy. So it's very complex. But basically, pantheism is the belief that God is the universe. Only one being exists. Okay? And God is that one being. Now, sometimes you'll have people that are... This is called monism. At the same time that only one being exists, at the same time, if you bow down and worship that one being, or you call it God, and you view it in a religious light, then it's pantheism. But if that monistic view is not viewed in from a religious light, you can believe that all reality is one being, but not be a pantheist. Okay. So, in other words, pantheism is the religious spin on monism. All reality is one being, and we call that one being God. Okay. Now, the reason why true traditional Christians cannot be pantheists is because we do not believe that God is the universe. We believe that God created the universe. Okay? Now, Christians believe that God is not limited by his creation. And since his creation is the space, time, matter, material universe, God is not limited by space. So God is everywhere present. Christians call that omnipresence. But that does not mean, because God is everywhere present, that does not mean that this wall is God, that Phil Fernandez is God. It means he's here, he's everywhere simultaneously, but it doesn't mean that therefore he is this building. He is the people that are here. Okay? So there is a separation. God exists separately from his creation, although he is everywhere present and he is actively involved with his creation. And so the pantheist would say with Shirley MacLaine on the beach, "I am God, I am God, I am God." The theist, whether it be a Christian theist, an Islamic theist, or a Judaism, they would say, "I am not God, and I had better get down on my knees and worship the Creator God, who also in some way has provided salvation for mankind." And of course, Christianity would say that way that has been provided has been through the Lord Jesus. And we'll talk about the incarnation in just a few minutes here. But another aspect of God being the universe is that God is viewed as being impersonal. Now, this board and this marker are both impersonal. They can't... personality implies intelligence, will, emotions, and the will there brings up the moral choice. Okay, so personality basically entails that there is at least a possibility of communicating with and making moral choices that you're responsible for. Even if a dog comes very close to these, but we would stop short of positing personality there. You yell at a dog when a dog does bad just to keep the dog from doing bad again, but the dog really doesn't know right from wrong. He just kind of goes with the program of his master, or he doesn't go with the program of his master, depending on whether he's a good dog or a bad dog. But in actuality, the dog really do not hold dogs morally responsible. Okay, so this idea is alien to pantheism. God is impersonal. That door is impersonal. If I tripped over a rock, I would not argue with the rock and say you were wrong to trip me. The rock is impersonal. Now, at the same time, the way the pantheist views this impersonal God is more like a force. Star Wars, Lucas, the guy that produced that, openly admitted he was trying to bring Eastern thought, Hinduistic type thought, Eastern pantheism, and trying to preach it in America through those movies. That's why instead of saying the Lord be with you, they said the Force be with you, the impersonal Force. Now, another problem with pantheism, so the Force is more like electricity or something along those lines, an invisible power. And most pantheists view the whole physical universe as more of an illusion, or at least less real than ultimate reality, which is this world soul or this world Force. What was it? I'm just going to say something and we're lost in the train of thought. Oh, yeah. In the end, Star Wars, Darth Vader turns out to be, what's the name of Luke Skywalker's father? Yeah, whatever it was. He turns out, Darth Vader, the bad guy, turns out to be the good guy as well. And see, that's a pantheistic thought that ultimately God is beyond good and evil, which, by the way, was the title of another work by Nietzsche. So ultimately, there's no real distinction between cruelty and non-cruelty, between evil and good, good and evil, okay? Whereas Christianity would say, and Islam and Judaism, that God by nature is good, he is the embodiment of good, therefore what he commands is good, and what he forbids is evil, okay? So there is a real distinction between murdering somebody and loving somebody. Some things really are good for all people at all times in all places, and some things are real.